It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Curious Wisconsin. We'll visit a state park with a unique natural and cultural heritage.
But first, Minnesota just became the first state in the nation to ban a controversial ingredient found in many antibacterial soaps. The chemical in question here is triclosan, which can also be found in a handful of other products as well.
Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton recently signed that ban into law, and it comes at a time when researchers and businesses are taking a closer look at triclosan and the possible effects it could be having on our health and the environment.
To help explain what's going on, we've got Elizabeth Dunbar with us. She's the environmental reporter at Minnesota Public Radio. She joins us from the studios there. Elizabeth, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
So let's start with the chemical itself, triclosan. What is it?
Well, it's an antimicrobial agent, and it's added to all sorts of products. So soaps, toothpaste, yoga mats, cutting boards, cosmetics, and it's been around since the 1960s.
And the idea here being that this chemical will kill bacteria and presumably make us healthier. Is that it?
Correct. Yep. That's why it's added to all sorts of products.
And what has happened now that it's starting to get a little more controversial?
Well, the real thrust for the ban here in Minnesota was the environmental impact of triclosan. University of Minnesota has done a few studies that show that this chemical builds up in the environment. It builds up in lakes and rivers. And under the right conditions, triclosan can form a byproduct that turns into a dioxin. And dioxins are generally not good. They can be carcinogens. They can have impacts on wildlife. And there's been some studies that link triclosan to hormone disruption in animals. And so there's a lot of concern about what the long-term impacts of using this chemical could be.
And Minnesota became the first state to pass a ban on the chemical. How did the state lawmakers start getting interested in this issue?
Well, it was the environmental groups here really pushed it hard, and they cited these University of Minnesota studies, which looked at lakes right here in Minnesota where this is having an impact and where we could find evidence of triclosan building up over time. And the lawmakers also paid really close attention to what health experts are saying because, of course, if this chemical is beneficial, they wouldn't want to ban it. However, the Food and Drug Administration has said there's no evidence that triclosan in soaps is any better than just using plain soap and water. And we have a nationally known infectious disease expert here at the University of Minnesota, Michael Osterholm, who has also been very vocal on this topic. And he says it's triclosan is not any better. And he actually says if you're trying to get rid of germs, you should use an alcohol-based hand rub instead of a triclosan soap.
And I read that triclosan doesn't, as far as we know, kill norovirus, which is one of the biggies that you're looking out for when you're using antibacterial products.
Right, the common stomach bug, it doesn't even get at that. So that's a concern.
And there have been some reactions already from the makers of products. Johnson & Johnson, I guess, is already moving to phase it out. But what about other companies? How are they responding?
Well, like you mentioned, Johnson & Johnson, Procter & Gamble, GlaxoSmithKline, a lot of companies have already said they're phasing this out of their products. So the effect of a ban in Minnesota, we don't know really the extent. There are some companies, Dial Soap still uses triclosan. Colgate Total Toothpaste has it in their toothpaste, but the ban here in Minnesota only applies to soaps, so that won't be a concern for them. But Dial Soap, they would have to change their products, but there is some time to do this. The ban starts in January 2017, and it applies to consumer products, so meaning you cannot buy a soap or a body wash that contains triclosan on your grocery store shelf starting in January 2017.
So it just concerns soap so far. How come? Why does it stop there?
Well, that's what the FDA has said, that they have found no evidence that triclosan is any more effective than just regular soap and water, so that there's no real benefit there. However, the FDA has looked at the toothpaste and says it does kill gingivitis. The environmental concerns about this, now FDA's Food and Drug Administration, they're looking at the health impacts on humans, whereas advocates here in Minnesota were concerned about the environmental impacts. Now, I have talked to environmentalists here who were pushing this ban, and they said that about 90% of the triclosan use out there is soaps and body washes. So they think that this ban really is going to make a difference.
And I've heard that environmental concern expressed also as being that Minnesota, being along the Mississippi, is at the top of the watershed. And what happens in Minnesota can, you know, trickle down literally and affect the rest of the country.
Right. Yeah, that's also a factor here. The main environmental group who had pushed this is Friends of the Mississippi River. So they're very conscious of that.
What kind of response is the ban getting so far?
Well, the industry, there were some industry groups that fought it early on, and the ban in the legislature was actually scaled back a bit. So it only, like we mentioned, is only soaps and body washes and only what you'd buy in a store. So consumer products, it's not, you know, the types of soaps that restaurants or hospitals might buy. Industry was happy with some of the scaling back of this. Also, the effective date was pushed back to that 2017, so it gives them some more time. So I think that in the end, the companies felt like this was something that they could live with. However, it is a bit awkward because Minnesota is the only state that has this, and so they've got to now either decide to, you know, take triclosan out of all of their products or somehow figure out a way to distribute non-triclosan products to Minnesota.
When you think of laws like this, you think of, well, I tend to think of California, where they require labeling of all kinds of chemicals in workspaces that contain chemicals that are known to pose health risks. This is something, it seems like, unusual for Minnesota to do. What does this mean about, I don't know, a direction that Minnesota might be going in and how it might affect the rest of the country?
Well, triclosan isn't the only chemical that Minnesota policymakers are paying attention to. There's other contaminants of emerging concern, as they're known, that have been on people's radar. But I think the impact on our water. I mean, we're the land of 10,000 lakes, and if there is a chemical that we can find evidence of it building up and possibly forming toxic products that could hurt our wildlife, hurt the fish, all the things that we in our state hold so dear, then and on the other hand, that there's not a real clear benefit to having this chemical in a soap. I think this was something that got overwhelming support at our legislature in the end. And I think a lot of people think that other states might follow suit, seeing how this overwhelmingly passed here, and using some common sense, also looking at the industry itself, that the industry is moving away from this.
So we'll be watching to see if another domino falls. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
We've been talking about Minnesota's decision to ban the chemical triclosan with Elizabeth Dunbar, environmental reporter at Minnesota Public Radio.
Wisconsin has a lot of sites that tell a story about Native American history.
One of the most spectacular in terms of its natural and man-made wonders is Rocha Cree, a state park near Adams and Friendship in central Wisconsin.
State archaeologist John Broyhan can tell us where we're going to find there. And John, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, first I have to confess, I have lived in Wisconsin my whole life, and I've driven by that sign a million times, and I've never turned in, and it sounds like I'm missing something. Let's start with the real practical element of this. Where is Rocha Cree State Park?
It's located just a short distance north of Adams Friendship along State Trunk Highway 13.
Now, let's talk about that name a little bit. What does Rocha Cree mean?
Well, I looked it up. I had to look it up, too, and there are a couple definitions. The one that seems to be most frequently used is crevice in the rock. But I also found a definition that indicated that it might mean shouting or whooping rock.
So one of the promos for this was that it contains a lot of natural and man-made wonders. So let's start with the natural wonders first. What is it about Rochacree State Park that makes it such a pretty place?
I think it's the sandstone outcrops there. It was during the glaciation. It was on the bottom of Glacial Lake Wisconsin. And there was a good deal of erosion, but not all of the sandstone eroded away. And so you have these great tall sandstone outcrops that extend very high in the air. And if you crawl up to the top or climb up to the top of the stairs at Rochacree, you can see central Wisconsin. So it's a very spectacular place.
And so getting to history for a bit here, what do we know about Native American presence at the park? When did they first come there? And do we know what attracted them to this particular site?
Well, Native people were in central Wisconsin 10 or 11,000 years ago. The rock art there in the rock painting there probably dates to much later in time, maybe 3,500 years ago. And the reason they chose that particular location, I think, remains a mystery. It's not a typical rock art location in the sense that it's not in a cave or in a crevice cave. It's in an exposed area. Perhaps something happened when people were visiting there that indicated it was an important spiritual place. Perhaps there was some other event there that drew people to that. Maybe this French name of whooping or shouting rock. There was some sort of a sound that came out of that rock at some point. Maybe it was struck by lightning, something like that.
So let's talk about those rock paintings, because that is very intriguing. And a lot of people, when they think of paintings like that, they think of some of the famous ones that they've read about in magazines and so forth. But right here in Wisconsin, we've got these terrific examples. You say they're about 3,500 years old, give or take. Tell us what we're looking at when we're looking at these paintings.
Well, there are rock paintings there, and those paintings are done in reddish or reddish-orange pigment. They seem to depict four characters. These characters, in some instances, they look like human beings, and others, they look like birds. They are, in fact, probably spiritual beings that are taking on the characteristics of human or birds as they move through their spiritual world. The wings look like thick tooth combs. The bodies are broad-shouldered, narrow hips. They kind of look like terracotta pots for flowers and that sort of thing.
So do we know exactly who painted these?
The paintings were probably done between around 1300 or 1400 years ago, or AD. And at that point, people in that area were, archaeologists referred to them as Oneota. They were agriculturalists, grew corn, beans, and squash. And so that's the communities that were present in the area.
So when did archaeologists and historians or others first become aware of these? And how did they find them? They were just walking through the woods and saw them?
Yes, the people, as they moved through that area, they recognized them in the middle part of the 19th century as the paintings weren't visible initially. They were really not recorded until the 1980s. Before that, people quickly recognized that there were carvings there. Some of these look like a V with a line in the middle or a Y with a line in the middle. Others look like crescents. Some people refer to those as canoes.
Now, early on, you mentioned that these differ from a lot of other paintings and things that we see because they're more exposed. And I have to ask, how have they survived all these years?
They're in remarkable shape, actually, considering the fact that they're on a south-facing exposure, and there's nothing at this point in time. There's not a lot of tree cover in the area to keep them away from the hot sun of summer or the cold winds of winter. And they're exposed to the rain and the snow, so that's really the biggest threat to rock art sites in Wisconsin at this point in time, are just natural elements.
And elsewhere in Wisconsin, how common are rock art? How common are rock paintings?
Rock paintings are extremely uncommon. We only know about 10 of those in Wisconsin. Rock art itself, currently we have a list of about 160 locations. That's certainly underrepresents the number of rock art sites that are probably out there.
And in terms of ones that are accessible to the public that we could actually go take a look at, how common is that?
Rocher Cree remains the only publicly accessible rock art site.
Really? I had no idea. So when you say accessible, and I've not been there, as I say, so if I want to go take a look at these things, is it right off of a trail? Is it easy to get to if I'm interested in taking a walk there?
It is, actually. It's right on the entrance road, and there's a parking lot nearby, and then there's a viewing platform in front of the rock art that has a series of panels that talk about the rock art and explain how it was done and what it dates to.
So as you look at those now, you tell me they're in remarkable shape for their age. How do you keep them that way? Do you take any preservation efforts, or do we just let them age naturally?
Up to this point in time, we've just let them age naturally. We have documented them about as thoroughly as you can. We've taken a variety of color and black and white images. We've done drawings. So that's really the preservation way we preserve them at this point in time. In the past, people have tried to take molds of them, but those, in many cases, taking those molds actually probably do more damage than not taking the mold. So we've sort of stayed away from that. There are some new advances in photography, digital imaging, that people are working with, and that may be another way that we can address the long-term preservation of these sites.
So as you take a look at these from sort of an archaeological perspective, do you have any ideas, any speculation, any knowledge as to how significant these paintings may have been when they were first created? Were they more like graffiti, or was it more than that, something more serious?
Well, most of these paintings occur in caves or crevice caves, and those are seen as entrance points between the our world and the underworld. And so these were very spiritually charged areas. And so it leads us to believe that these paintings and these carvings were very much spiritually derived and oriented. They may have told important stories about the community. They may have been done by individuals who were seeking guidance from the spirit world or trying to seek a balance with the spirit world. It seems unlikely that they were just done as graffiti or were just done as fun.
And you also mentioned carvings. Are those in the same location as the paintings, or are those elsewhere in the park?
No, they're in the same location as the paintings. And then if you go there, you'll also see a good deal of later carvings, what we refer to today as graffiti, people's names and dates and that sort of thing. So some of the earlier carvings have been disfigured by the later carvings.
So in terms of popularity with members of the public, is this a park that gets a lot of visits?
Yeah, it is very popular. It's centrally located, and if you're interested in experiencing one of Wisconsin's many different environments, going to Rocher Cree gives you a chance to get a feel for the Central Sands. It's very different than going to the Driftless area in southwestern Wisconsin or up north into the Great Forest.
So, and I also want to return to the idea of what the future of these paintings, these carvings look like. You mentioned that some of the carvings had graffiti and other carvings on them. How do you or do you protect them? Obviously, you can't be there 24 hours a day. Do you have problems with vandalism? Do you have problems with people trying to damage them?
There is some evidence that people have visited some of these locations and left their names and in initials. It seems to be more and more infrequent. And the best tool for protecting them is, A, to get them recorded and documented, and then, B, to make sure that everybody understands how important they are, how fragile they are, and how once the damage is done, you really can't undo it.
And it also makes me wonder, as you describe these paintings and these carvings, do you ever speculate as to whether there are other paintings and carvings out there somewhere that we just simply haven't found yet?
Yes, we do. We're just convinced that there are a lot more carvings and rock art sites, particularly in southern Wisconsin, central Wisconsin, and even in up north where you get some of the Precambrian bedrock outcrops.
Well, John, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was state archaeologist John Broyhan, and we've been talking about Rochacree State Park. We're talking about a new report from the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago called the Industrial Cities Initiative. The report looks at 10 Midwestern industrial towns in Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, and Wisconsin.
Jeremiah Boyle is with us now to talk about the report and its conclusions. He's the Managing Director of Economic Development for the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. Jerry, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be with you.
So let's just start with some basics here. How do you define an industrial city?
Well, for purposes of our study, we defined industrial cities as cities that in 1960 had a population of at least 50,000 and 25% of its employment in manufacturing.
Okay, and what cities are we talking about here?
Well, in Wisconsin, we're talking the ones that we profiled, which is not a complete list of all the industrial cities in the Midwest. The Wisconsin cities that we profiled were Green Bay and Racine. We also did Waterloo and Cedar Rapids in Iowa, Joliet and Aurora in Illinois, Gary, Indiana, and Fort Wayne, Indiana, and then Grand Rapids and Pontiac, Michigan. So we did two in each of the states that we cover in the Federal Reserve's district.
So you looked at these 10 cities, and what was the goal of the report? What were you looking for?
Really what we're trying to determine in this report is, given the fact that all of the cities that we profiled had all the same characteristic of a loss of manufacturing employment, we wanted to see why some of those cities seem to have been outperform their peer cities and why some of them seem to have underperformed their cities. And if you'd like, I could give a little bit of an explanation of what outperforming or underperforming means in this report.
Absolutely, sure.
Okay. What we did was we looked at if manufacturing employment were the only explanatory variable for the economic outcomes for these cities over the period from 1960 to today, what would those cities look like in terms of their total population, their total employment, and their median family incomes? The cities that we identify as outperforming their peers are really the ones who had outcomes that were better than the model predicted, and the underperforming were those that underperformed what the model predicted, if manufacturing employment were the only predictive variable.
And in looking at your summary, it's interesting. You have the prediction of the outcomes of the cities themselves, and there was also a bigger question that was embedded in there. It sounds like with a global world, you were wondering, could the Midwest itself survive? How viable was the Midwest? That's a big question. Do you think these 10 cities represent the Midwest as a whole?
In many ways, they do. Statisticians would not call them representative, but we do think we got a pretty good sampling of various dynamics that are at work in these types of cities. So we know from the general literature that the outcome for industrial cities, whether it be here in the Midwest or the Northeast, can generally be explained by a number of variables, but two very important ones are, number one, the extent to which employment in these cities was concentrated in manufacturing in 1960, and number two, the extent to which there is an education deficit within these cities. So those two variables alone can explain 40% of the outcome for these cities, but the interesting thing is that there's about 60% of the outcome for these cities that really are open to different ways that local leaders and local decision makers can have an influence on what direction the city goes, especially when they're talking about how to diversify their own local economies.
How do the industrial cities in the Midwest that we're talking about here, how do they compare with industrial cities in other parts of the country?
Well, the only really good comparison is with the Northeast. There are plenty of mill towns and mining towns in the Southeast. But for the most part, the industrial cities in this country were really pretty much concentrated in what has come to be known as the Rust Belt. At one point, they were known as the Arsenal of Democracy, where the Arsenal of Democracy was created. But those are all spread through the Midwest and the Northeast. And the interesting thing of comparing those two is that while we in the Midwest had a kind of a manufacturing renaissance in the mid-90s, that is, employment seemed to be picking up a little bit for Midwest manufacturing, manufacturing in the Northeast continued to decline. So while the Midwest had a little bit of a renaissance, which slowed but did not reverse the decline of manufacturing employment. So that's really the only comparison, is that the Northeast seems to have been gotten farther along in the transition to a more diversified economy a little bit sooner than the Midwest has.
So it sounds like that trend has hit the Midwest as well after that little burst in the 90s, which leads to that popular notion that manufacturing cities, they're dead, and it's sort of an epitaph of sorts. How does the data measure up? Is this true? Are manufacturing cities dead, or at least as far as manufacturing goes?
Actually, the more time you spend in some of these cities, the more you realize that they are far from dead. One of the interesting things to observe, and you can see this sort of graphically in the report, and we do encourage people to go and see the report for themselves at chicagofed.org. It's right up there at the top of our homepage, is that there is this popular notion of what these cities look like, and it's all based on the worst of the worst of these cities. So a bankrupt Detroit with the images of nothing but abandoned buildings and that kind of thing tends to be people's image. But when you look at these cities compared to each other and compared to trends overall in the U.S., many of them come across as being not nearly as bad as one would think, and some of them come out looking much better.
Now, Green Bay is an interesting example. I know in your new report you didn't sort of pit one city against another and compare them that way, but Green Bay is a city that has come back. What is Green Bay doing?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, Green Bay is one of those cities that, when as compared to the other cities in our population that we studied, did not have as high a concentration of manufacturing employment to begin with. So their fall was a little bit smaller. However, there are some very interesting things going on in Green Bay that we do think may be a good thing for other cities to know about, and that is, leadership in these cities is a very important characteristic for those cities that seem to have outperformed their peers. And it's a very specific kind of leadership. It's not an individual leader providing that leadership. It is a group of leaders that have come together who are able to articulate an economic development vision that is shared broadly around the community. They're able to marshal the resources to implement that vision, and they're able to implement that vision over time. All of these cities are dealing with very long-term trends that they're trying to address, and therefore they can't really depend on renewing or reviewing their strategies every 4 years or so. They need to have a leadership group in place that can sustain these efforts over time.
Now, when you talk about a group of leaders that has a common vision and they implement this vision over time, does that just sort of happen organically? Is it, you know, sort of serendipity, or is it something that can be consciously recreated in a different city?
I think it is consciously recreated. The interesting thing is the catalyst for bringing a group like that together can vary from place to place. In some places, it does come together around a charismatic leader, although that's by and large, I think, the exception to the rule. There are some cities where philanthropy is really the catalyst to bring people together around the table. In Green Bay, it happened to be a manufacturing alliance that brought people together to say, you know, we have issues in business, but we also have issues with our education system, and we are better off working on these things together than we are having several different competing visions.
So Green Bay is a city that is moving in a good direction. It has a big paper industry now. Racine is a city that has, according to past reports of yours, been struggling a bit more. How is Racine faring?
Yeah, you know, to say that Racine has been struggling a little bit more is probably not what I would choose to say these days, because, number one, It's not that they're struggling now. It's that from the beginning of the study period, they had, again, a much higher concentration in manufacturing employment. Their manufacturing employment started at closer to 50%. And so their decline was steeper during the course of the study.
You called them in your 2012 report a fading city. So what does that mean?
Well, that was an attempt to try to simplify the different elements of the initial regression analyses to compare the relative changes in manufacturing employment as compared to the other metrics that we were using. And in 2012, we sort of paused what we were doing in our study and produced a white paper to invite the leaders of these various cities to see what we were doing, to give us some input, and then to be able to expand upon our initial findings. And so Racine becomes a very interesting sort of case study for us, because while they did have the steeper decline, and based on the data alone, it might fit into that kind of category, but it's hard to describe Racine as fading now when you think about the fact that they have put themselves in many ways on a world stage by participating in the OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, with their freshwater work in Racine, but also in this effort to try to tie together a coherent regional entity around Chicago in this sort of tri-state Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana economic entity.
We're talking right now with Jerry Boyle of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago about their new report on industrial cities in the Midwest and how they're faring.
And that report, by the way, is available on the Central Time Facebook page if you'd like to check it out. But we'd like to hear from you, too. Do you live in one of these industrial Midwestern cities in Green Bay or in Racine? How are things looking there? How have they changed since 1960? And what do you think can be done to improve things in your community? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or drop us an email at talk@WPR.org.
We're continuing our conversation now with Jerry Boyle of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago about the bank's new report on Midwestern industrial cities.
And we'd like to hear from you on this topic. Do you know an industrial Midwestern city either in Wisconsin or maybe in Iowa or Illinois? Is it a place you used to live or that you live now? How are things looking there? How have things changed in the past 30 or 40 years? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@WPR.org.
And Jerry, we were just talking about how the 2012 report, you had categorizations of cities, and some were fading and some were sort of thriving a little bit more. You haven't done that in this new report. Why did you make that choice not to use categorizations?
Well, for two reasons, actually. Number one, we do not wish to pass judgment on any of these cities. What we'd like to do is have these cities be in a place where they could learn from each other and perhaps even cooperate on certain things where that makes sense. There's also a second issue that as we looked deeper behind the data that we had used for the preliminary analysis, there were some cities that appeared to be outperforming their peers more dramatically than it turns out they really are. So some cities that seemed to have a lot of population growth and were able to have an increase in their median family income, it turns out a lot of that story was really about annexation. They were able to take in more land and annex communities around them more recently than a number of their peers. So a lot of the population growth and growth in wealth really was not what you would think of as organic growth. It was that they were able to reach out and bring that growth into the city. And that's really not a tool that is generally available for similarly situated cities. So we wanted to be a little bit careful to place these cities in the wrong context. or to not place them in the wrong context. So we were more careful in this report to not be making those kinds of judgments.
I want to go to the phones right now. Let's take a caller here. This is Paul joining us from Racine. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Pretty good. How about you?
Oh, I'm doing just great. I just got off of work. I'm on my way home.
That's always a good feeling. So you're in Racine. What is your take on this?
Well, I was born and raised in Racine, and I really got to say I love this town. I mean, I bought a house 3 years ago when the market was low, and I know a lot of people have been saying that with lower housing prices, you know, comes a lot of, you know, judgment from the censuses and that. But I think it's more of a generational change. I mean, not only did I buy a house in the neighborhood, but my cousin bought a house next to me and that. And, you know, it's we're building our own community together there. And and a lot of people in town have always been saying that Racine's been one of the biggest small towns you'll ever know.
And it sounds like you've seen some changes in the past couple of years that have been good ones.
Yeah, there have been a lot of good changes. There have been a lot of festivals in town. We have, like, Party on the Pavement, and there have been jet ski races the past couple years, which we've never had before. Racine's got one of the nicest beaches. I know people from Milwaukee that will drive all the way down just to hang out at our beach.
Mm, cool. Well, thank you so much for giving us your take on Racine. That was Paul we were talking to there. And Jerry, he was kind of getting at some of the community things there, the sense of place and well-being, things that bring a community together. How do factors like that work in this picture?
Well, they're obviously very hard to quantify, but he's absolutely right that is an important story for all of these cities, the extent to which they are able to make their cities more livable, even in the face of a number of their challenges. And this goes back to what I said in the beginning, is that there are a lot of things that don't show up in the data that were very important for us to get that story and combine that with the data, because that really does supplement what the data tells you. The data alone don't tell you everything you need to know about these cities. And the improvement in the quality of life in a number of these cities is obviously very important. Reclamations of waterfronts and reclaiming and renovating downtowns are very important characteristics, because the other thing that shows up is the people in these cities who maintain that level of civic pride and spread the word about these cities and the advantages that they have really do offer that glimmer of hope, even for the most underperforming cities. So you get a city like Gary, Indiana, where part of the emerging story is the extent to which people who grew up in Gary went somewhere else and have had successful careers, but now are coming back because they're getting the sense that they're coming in at the ground floor to help revitalize the city in which they were born. I think that's a very important but hard to quantify story that is emerging in a number of these cities.
In terms of other six cities that are outperforming what the expected would have been, what are the big takeaways here for all of these industrial cities?
From the cities that are outperforming?
Right, for the success stories, what are they doing?
Yeah, again, the number one story, I think, is that leadership group that has come together that has all of those characteristics of a shared vision, the ability to marshal the resources, and the ability to implement that over time. And the other thing that I forgot to say earlier is that, by and large, those cities are able to put together that strategy and put it in the context of at least a regional setting, if not a global setting. So that's the other thing about a city like Green Bay, is that Green Bay is really not going it alone. They are central to an 18-county region that becomes a lot more interesting in the global context, because it's got a much bigger labor shed, and the fact that it's coordinated means that they can attract businesses and help businesses grow in a way that is simpler than it would be for some communities where every city and every individual community is trying to implement an economic development strategy and going it alone.
And what about educating workers and helping them find jobs that might not be what they were used to, educating them and finding placement for them?
That is the most commonly shared challenge for all of the leaders in these communities. and that is that while the trends in all of these cities tends to be very good, the percentage of their population that has no high school diploma has been decreasing, the percentage of their population that has a college degree has been increasing. But for most of these cities, even as those trends are positive, they're having trouble closing the gap with the rest of the country. So while it's still necessary to continue on that, it remains a challenge to close the gap with the rest of the country so that the competitive advantage that other places have with regards to a qualified workforce would begin to diminish.
And to touch on just another aspect as we get close to our time here, you say that race and diversity, they present both a challenge and an opportunity. How do you see that coming into play right now?
Well, right now, a number of cities sort of struggle with this. And when you think about the leadership types of groups that I've been talking about, a number of these cities self-report that the ability to include a diverse set of voices and the voices of the less well-off, in some cases, they actually call it their own Achilles heel. And there is some research out there that indicates that even in communities around the country that have had a good deal of job creation, just but that number by itself, a lot of those metro areas also have the biggest increase in poverty rate, which sort of opens the whole debate about income inequality, in that what that means is that you get a growing number of working poor, that even as jobs are created, which tends to be the holy grail of a lot of economic development strategies, the job creation number by itself appears to not be enough, that even as jobs grow, there's a kind of a hollowing out that you see in cities like this where the wages are not keeping up with the living wage of a community. The poverty rate is going up in these communities, even as the rent burden in these communities is going up.
Well, so Jerry,
yes,
you left us with a challenge there, but it sounds like a lot for these cities to celebrate and keep on improving. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about it.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Jeremiah Boyle, Managing Editor of Economic Development for the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago.